Be seated. You know, just think about the implications of the last bit of that scripture from Mark. If George Burns had heard it, he would be thinking about and thinking about Jesus in today's gospel. He might have said, "Happiness is having a large, loving, close-knit family in another city." A family is continually becoming what becomes it. It's every christening and every commencement, every falling in love, every fight, every departure, every return. It's the sound of the phone ringing in the middle of the night, or lying awake for hours waiting for the phone to ring. It's the children laughing, brothers wrestling, parents offering advice, lovers whispering or crying, and the silence after a door is slammed shut. For anyone who's had one fall apart, a family's wings are gossamer, a web so delicately spun that it takes almost nothing to set the whole thing shuddering or to tear it to pieces. Yet, the thread it's woven of is as strong as anything on earth. I believe the depth of our longing for connection has everything to do with the family that gave us our start, and that we can shape our current communities with the new, perhaps healthier systems that we've been building since then. You know, if you're looking for snapshots of an ideal family, of life-giving parent, child, and sibling relationships, you know, the Bible is probably not the place to start looking. Consider Abraham almost sacrificing his son Isaac on a makeshift altar, or the crippling favoritism that Isaac later showers on one of his twins, or old Samuel and his shiftless sons, or the awful tangle between David and his children Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom, whose saga you'll remember includes a rape and a murder within their most intimate circle. And Mark reveals the tension within Jesus' family. One translation of today's gospel says, "When his family heard what was happening, they came to take control of him. They were saying, 'He's out of his mind.'" Yet, much of the tradition is uncomfortable suggesting that Jesus had trouble getting along with his closest relatives. The King James Version totally removes Jesus' family from this part of the story, saying instead, "And when his friends heard of it, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, 'He's beside himself.'" Other translations put the disparagement of Jesus in the mouths of anonymous other people instead of his kinfolk. And then the authors of Matthew and Luke, written after the time of the Gospel of Mark, omit entirely from their stories any hint that Jesus' family thought he was disturbed. Yet Mark reveals its complexity. The wider context of the story is a controversy over authority, clearly involving religious influential leaders and Jesus' family, with both groups expressing trouble understanding who he is and what his actions mean. The scribes who came down from Jerusalem conclude he's possessed by Satan, the tempter, while his family worries he's lost his sanity. And in this ancient setting, these two diagnoses are roughly equivalent to each other. You know, it's an old story, really, to label a challenge to the status quo as crazy talk. We've seen that before. And in this case, both allegations attempt to discredit the one who's trying to facilitate health. We've seen that before, too. I think Jesus is experiencing here what a modern person might discover when he exposes a bully in the workplace, or what an abused spouse discovers when she begins to take care of herself. The system pushes back against her. Or what happens when the son of slaves reveals the violence of low expectations. You see, what Jesus does here is he pulls the curtain back on a system which began with good intentions but has become toxic and perverse. For all of us, This scene underscores how difficult it can be to digest Jesus' good and healing news, especially if we're invested in an old and limiting way. Let's be honest. If what's new and life-giving threatens what we've gotten comfortable with, we act like we can't hear it. Jesus is talking about a radical redefinition of the human family here. And a lot of us would rather he didn't get into our business. But if you're from a family that doesn't work, it sounds so sweet. Or if you're from a part of the culture, a part of the human family that's been marginalized and pushed to the side, it's good news to know that what the society has told you is family is limited and toxic and that there's more. As Jesus announced and re-inaugurated God's intentions for human flourishing, many could not overcome the disorienting character of his message. Even close relatives and religious insiders were bewildered by what he said. And is it any surprise that his words and ways about the family of man are suspect? Think about it. A single, childless man in a patriarchal society defined by narrow norms and legalism? I'm sure some of them were thinking, how can a person without a spouse or children teach us anything about how a family is supposed to work? He doesn't have anything to tell me. The story digs a little deeper. It says, then his mother and brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. I want you to imagine that picture. Mama and brothers are standing outside. They've got to send an emissary in to get to him. So we know something is being changed. The crowd sitting around said to Jesus, your mother and your brother and sisters are outside asking for you. If we didn't get the notion that there was a wall somehow, we know it now. And Jesus replies with a shocking query. Who are my brother? Who are my mother and my brothers? Now just imagine how Mary must have felt when she heard that. How would you feel if your son said to you, you're standing outside, you can't get into the party, you're not invited in, and your son says, when you send the message in, he said, who's calling? That's what Jesus is saying here. So I think that's to invite us into how strange this might be and help us to understand that there's something new going on, and to let us be able to see that this is a radical new way to understand family, because even his mama has to come up with a new definition. And then he says, and looks at the people around him, he answers his own question, who is my mother and who are my brothers? It's you. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. And this is good news for the folks inside the house that day who identify with Jesus and his teaching. And it's good news for Mark's earliest readers who often found themselves estranged from their biological families. Think of the disciples and everyone that they left behind. But this is pretty hard to take for his relatives standing outside and for anyone with a high regard for conventional notions of honor and social stability. In a stunning and probably painful exchange with his relatives, Jesus redefines family altogether here. For him and his way, family will no longer be determined by blood relations, by kinship ties, or the rules of inheritance. Life-giving family is defined by something bigger, less parochial, more inclusive, characterized by mutual respect. And hear this, called to the work of leveling generations of uneven playing fields. That's where it might get a little uncomfortable for us. We love our families. We take care of them. We tend to give our inheritance to the people we're related to, don't we? Right? And that's all right. But Jesus here is suggesting that maybe that's all right, but it's not enough. Because what if you're not in line for any kind of inheritance, financial or otherwise? This gospel is meant to turn our worlds upside down, so that maybe those who are living at the very bottom might find some light and air. You see, our family is much bigger than we thought it was. Who's in our gang after all? Prostitutes, thieves, widows, the childless, immigrants, angry older brothers, the prodigal, the Ethiopian, the Samaritan, the Greek, the Jew, the wealthy benefactor, the never married, the thrice married, gay, straight, trans, Republican, Democrat, independents, they're all in the family. Even national fans, they're in the family. And our call is to weave the streets of Baltimore and its various factions and fractured relationships into a living fabric that joins disparate, unlikely, even antagonistic strands together. The courage and will to love is what makes a family, not blood. And that's good news. The courage and will to love is what makes a family, not blood. The true human family is what Jesus lived and died to help create, reminding us that we come from the same beginning and we're headed towards the same conclusion, and that in the meantime, our lives are elaborately and inescapably linked. Let me tell you a story. Cecile Gilbert has moved 26 times since her birth in San Antonio in 1962. She writes, "I believe that families are sometimes the people that show up and love you when no one else will." In May 1977, she says, "I lived in a Howard Johnson's motel off of Interstate 10 in Houston. My dad and I shared a room with two double beds and a bathroom way too small for a modest 15-year-old girl and her father. Dad's second marriage," she said, "was in trouble, and my stepmother had kicked us both out of the house the previous week. Dad had no idea what to do with me, and that's when my other family showed up. Barbara and Roland Beach took Cecile into their home because their only biological daughter, Sue, Cecile's best friend, asked them if they would. So she lived with them for the next 7 years, and in that time, Barb starched her drill team skirts just the same as she did for Sue. She made sure that she had lunch money and doctor's appointments and help with homework and Jordache jeans. It was 1977, after all. She got a puka shell necklace when Sue got a puka shell necklace. She got hugs at bedtime. Barbara and Roland attended every game and every play, and when Cecile and her friend left for rival colleges, those new parents made sure that her room stayed the same for her the whole time she was gone. Cecile writes, "The Beaches knew all about me when they took me in. When I was 7, my mother died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, and from then on, my father relied on other people to raise his kids. By the time she went to live with Barbara and Roland, Cecile believed that life was unfair, that love was tenuous, that people were untrustworthy, and that she was going to have to make it on her own for the rest of her life." Cecile says, "What happened is that some people who didn't have to opened their hearts to her, and that revelation helped her see how closed and bitter her own heart had become. They offered consistency and affection and laid those gifts alongside the anxiety and loneliness and, let's be honest, the trauma that had shaped her to that point. And that was enough for Cecile to begin to find herself." She said, "It's been a long road to something like recovery, but along the way, she's come to a new understanding of what a family can be." Jesus lived and died for that kind of family, the kind of family that blows up our expectations and our assumptions, the kind of family that doesn't keep us prisoner to what someone else's expectations are for us, but instead blows up our possibilities so that we can finally become the child that we were born to be. 1,000 of us caught a glimpse of Jesus' family values last Wednesday night at Kingdom Life Church in West Baltimore, We were old and young, black, white, and brown, Spanish-speaking, gospel-singing, Pentecostal, and Episcopalian, and we filled an auditorium to overflowing to compel the mayor to use the power of her office to make Baltimore work for children and immigrants and business owners again, because we're not going to get where we need to go unless children and immigrants and business owners and preachers and house owners and house renters and everybody is working together to make this into the city that it was born to be. And what we did is we gathered together in just an exercise of the social contract and said to the mayor, we're here and we want you to do what you have said you would do. You can't solve all the problems, but you've got a role to play because you wield some power that one of us doesn't by himself, but that I'm telling you, 1,100 of us, maybe we do. And it was theater. It had been worked out ahead of time, but she agreed in front of television cameras and reporters from the Baltimore Sun to honor those expectations and to make it possible and make it more certain that children won't feel afraid to walk home from their schools in the afternoon or walk to their schools in the morning afraid. And she said she would do something about making sure that the funding for the Kerwin Commission would be ratified, that we would do that hard work together. And she said that I'll do something about immigrants being able to have IDs from their parishes so that when they're stopped by the police or that somebody knocks on their door and says, who are you? They'll have some way to say, this is who I am and I'm part of something bigger, which is the human family. It was just a step, a public pledge that must be measured by action and lives improved. But it felt like church that last Wednesday at that Kingdom Hall auditorium, I'm telling you. It felt like church for a minute. Like maybe we'd done something that might make a difference, as if the tattered strands of a broken family had been woven into something stronger than we thought was possible. Because you see, when Jesus teaches and touches us, everything gets put up for renegotiation. And that's what we did on Wednesday night. We renegotiated our relationship with the mayor. We became a stronger city, at least for a moment. We renegotiated because we've got a relationship with this teacher, this pastor, this prophet, Jesus. When Jesus teaches and touches you, everything is open to redefinition, and every one of us is open to renewal. So what is a family? Look around. Whenever we stand up for people that the world would discount or dismiss, we become the family of God. Amen.